the importance not only of protecting children, which is of utmost importance, but also the importance of being able to practice our religion.
A state bill aims to intervene in the sacred seal of confession, how the church is responding, and analysis on legislative attempts to remove confidentiality from the sacrament.
A mother has the choice to an abortion, but she should also have a choice to undo that abortion. It's still a choice. And to take away that choice, like I said, it's completely wrong.
A mother shares her emotional story of saving her baby by taking the abortion reversal pill. Why mothers in her state may not have that option in the future.
And I'll be bringing you inside the workshop of an incredibly talented Italian artist who is bringing the faith to life through stunning mosaics.
The people that I do, you speak to, they would say this is unacceptable. And certainly, we would say it's non-negotiable.
Reaction from the Bishop of Wilmington, Delaware, to a legislative proposal in his state that would break the seal of confession, requiring priests in his diocese to report child abuse and neglect revealed by a penitent in the confessional. Welcome to EWTN News In Depth. The Sacrament of Reconciliation is a foundational element of our Catholic life and church theology, a repentance of sins and a direct plea for God's mercy in confidence, with a priest serving as the confessor. Catholic canon law notes that breaking the seal of silence is grounds for a priest to be automatically excommunicated, something only the Holy Father could forgive. Yet a Delaware lawmaker earlier this month introduced House Bill 74. The bill would repeal the privilege between priest and penitent in a sacramental confession relating to child abuse and neglect, and require a priest to report it in a judicial proceeding. The bill is currently awaiting action in committee as its sponsors line up expert witnesses and public comment. The Diocese of Wilmington, Delaware, says the proposal is a clear violation of the First Amendment, protecting freedom of religion.
If it goes to vote, we would certainly look to talk to the different legislators who are part of that voting. So that would be the first step. To have our people of Delaware to speak to their legislators. That's part of that, the legal process, certainly in our United States. Those would be the first steps that we certainly would take. And ultimately, it could also be looked at as far as even if this is constitutional. Even last week, Pope Francis, he said that there's no shortage of hotbeds of hatred and revenge. And as priests, as confessors, we need to strive to make hotbeds of God's mercy by offering the sacrament of reconciliation as widely as possible.
On Monday of Holy Week, April 3rd, the Diocese of Wilmington is holding its annual Reconciliation Monday. All parish churches will be open for priests to hear confessions and offer absolution in preparation for Easter. Bishop Koenig says protecting vulnerable people from abuse is of utmost importance and underscored that except for the sacrament of confession, his priests are already mandatory reporters under Delaware's child protection laws and through the diocese's own internal policies requiring the reporting of suspected child abuse incidents to civil authorities. Delaware is not the only state with a bill targeting confession. Vermont lawmakers also proposed an end to clergy exemptions for reporting confessed child abuse. The measure failed to move out of committee earlier this month, but its sponsor says he will be reintroducing it. And Utah lawmakers proposed four measures requiring clergy to report child abuse, including a bill that would end all confidentiality of all confessions. The legislative session for this year ended before the bills received a hearing. These states, Delaware, Vermont, and Utah, newly attempting to target the sacrament, join a handful of states which have already passed laws that interfere with the seal of confession in some way. To talk about these legislative actions to break the seal of confession from a legal and religious liberty perspective, we're joined by attorney Andrea Pacciotti Bayer. She's the director of the Conscience Project and a fellow at the Institute for Human Ecology at the Catholic University of America. Andrea, it's so great to have you here with us. How do bills breaking the seal of confession violate First Amendment rights? And why is this so important to the church?
Well, Monse, first, thank you so much for inviting me on. This is a really important issue that I'm glad all of your viewers are paying attention to. First off, you mentioned it. These are laws that are targeting religious activity. And just by targeting religious activity for disfavored treatment, they come into problems with the First Amendment. It's worth noting that other privileges like the attorney-client privilege remain in those jurisdictions. So we can see that this is directed towards something that is protected under the First Amendment as religious behavior and activity that needs to be treated fairly and on the same footing as other activity like the conversations between a lawyer and their client. The second is it brings the government into an important aspect of our faith, and that's the sacrament of confession. We've already seen from the Supreme Court recognition of what we call the ministerial exception. And that means that the government can't get into and looking at second guessing hiring decisions that we make for teachers and other ministers within our churches. And there's nothing more intimate to our inner workings as how we run our worship and our sacraments. So that's another issue that I think is an affront to the First Amendment in the attempt to repeal this privilege that's existed for such a long time in all 50 states.
Now, Andrea, how is the church unique in this sacrament? This targets the sacramental lives specifically, but does it target it in such a way that other faiths are not being placed under scrutiny for? Abuse in other communities is also prevalent, and it's not just the Catholic Church. Is this something that ignores those differences across faiths and only targets the Catholic Church?
You know, I think, Monse, that's a really interesting question. First, as you mentioned at the beginning of your presentation of this issue, priests are required outside of the confessional, both by their diocese and oftentimes in jurisdictions, to share information that they find. And members of our church community are considered mandatory reporters, along with pediatricians, teachers, coaches. That's a really important thing to make clear. So when we're saying that we're pushing against these attempts to kind of lift the seal of confession, it doesn't mean that Catholics aren't serious about child abuse. But there is an important and unique position that Catholics have related to the confession, the confessional, and the secrecy and the anonymity of the sacrament of confession. Some faith traditions share similar confidentiality. And when we look at privileges in different jurisdictions, they list priests and other ministers. But it does seem like, especially in these locations, they're targeting the Catholic Church specifically. And it's a desire to address our terrible history of child abuse, but it's getting at the wrong root problem. And attacking the confessional and the seal of confession, in my opinion, won't root out abuse, but can almost keep it in the dark.
Now, Andrea, that's true. The painful story of the scandals that continue to break in our church is real, and we're living through it as Catholics. But other states have successfully passed various versions of laws that target the seal of confession. North Carolina, New Hampshire, West Virginia, Oklahoma, Rhode Island, Texas, among them. How did those measures get through those legislatures, and how are they being applied?
You know, it's very interesting that you raised those. I haven't seen cases where priests were forced to divulge what was said in confession in those jurisdictions. So I think it's probably one of those cases of scoring political points by attacking the church, but finding that in practice, it's not a helpful or useful thing for local law enforcement to try to effectively put a cop in the confessional.
And is it possible that we'll see a challenge over these laws in federal courts or possibly at the Supreme Court?
You know, I think that we've heard from our church leaders in those jurisdictions that if they're pressed, not only first is it not going to be effective because priests will not violate the seal, but if there are fines or there are other kinds of threats against individual priests or the diocese, the church is ready to stand and defend religious freedom, church autonomy. And what I really hope would be avoided in all of this is that in trying to address child abuse, we're not pitting the church and local law enforcement against one another, but instead allowing us to strengthen those bonds that we have outside of the confessional, to be able to work with local law enforcement to address instances of child abuse or domestic abuse in general.
And to protect the vulnerable. Thank you so much for this analysis. Absolutely. And we'll be watching this carefully.
Thanks, Monse.
And of course, beyond the legal and religious liberty aspects is the supreme issue of the sacramental nature of reconciliation and the privacy between God, a priest confessor, and the penitent. Father Paul Hartman is a canon law expert and has a long history of pastoral care. He served as judicial vicar for the Metropolitan Tribunal in the Archdiocese of Milwaukee. He joins me here in the studio to discuss. Thank you so much for joining us. This is such a critical issue.
And thank you for having me. It's a joy to be able to offer some insight that hopefully will help not only Catholics and faithful in the pews in the confessional, but also the priests that are in the situation of trying to understand their role.
Absolutely. And those who are curious about the faith, I don't think these lawmakers have an idea of why this is so important. So clarify this for us. It's the Easter season or mm-hmm. ramping up to it. We're all thinking about confession so that we are in a state of worthiness to receive.
Sure.
Tell me why this is such a critical sacrament.
Well, clearly the whole reality of the need for redemption. That's first and foremost, how we engage in a sacramental way with our Lord in order that we're lifted of the burden of our sins. He died for us on a cross. He rose from the dead so that they would be removed. But there's still an expectation of our own fallen nature still getting the best of us, seeking that repaired relationship with the Lord. That's the track that's so important. We have to see this not specifically as an encounter with another privileged class. I know you spoke to a lawyer, like a doctor or even a spouse. This is not about the priest. This is about the priest acting in relationship with the penitent and with our Savior, with the Lord, in persona Christi.
In persona Christi. So then why is this concept of privacy or confidentiality so important?
Well, the very willingness of people to take that courageous, it is both humble and courageous at the same time, to share with someone, to speak the words, I have done something wrong. But the payoff is not only in the forgiveness, but it's hearing with the very reality of a voice saying, you are forgiven, your sins are absolved of you. So it's that sense of needing to have that interaction. But we have always done so on the basis of creating the image and the atmosphere of the prayer, of the relationship with Christ. Using a screen, having some anonymity, not allowing the priest to become a detective and ask more penetrating questions. Maybe to elicit an examination of conscience or to elicit a deeper sense of sorrow and amendment, but not to cross-examine, as it were. So we have this notion, this reality of drawing somebody into something which is transcendent. Mm. And so the anonymity and the secrecy serves that and exemplifies that.
And gives us that opportunity to be courageous and doesn't allow the identity of the priest to come into conflict with that.
Correct.
Some people worry about confessing to their priest boss, you know?
Yes.
And those are complicated questions.
Yes.
As someone who worked with seminarians, you've gotten all kinds of questions, all kinds of hypotheticals, you know, mm-hmm. Father, what happens if someone confesses to murder or mm-hmm. they confess to wanting to inflict self-harm, which we know is also sinful. What do you tell them?
Well, I think a couple of different levels. With the seminarians are always great because it's a stream of what-ifs. Mm-hmm. And often I tell them at a certain point when I have to kind of bring that class to closure, I'll say, if you actually get that question, you know, we'll write the journal article together at some point, because some of these don't happen as often as people would think, partly because some of the things that our mind goes to in outrageous sense are not necessarily people who are going to come to us in the first place, sadly. Now, how we help the young seminarians or the priests to kind of wrestle with this and pull it apart is really just bring them back to that role that they have. Again, it's not lawyer. It's not counselor, so to speak, not in a medical sense. It's being the conduit to Christ and to Christ's mercy and Christ's love and the invitation to transformation. So when we hear someone, whether it's a sense of fear that a sin, a crime might be committed again, or whether it's a sense of their well-being might be at risk, how do we, if we're connecting them to the Lord, if we're being a means for them to be connected to the church, they've come to confession. They know they want something and need something. How can we encourage them in that moment to, if it's a child, go seek a trusting adult, you know, even asking, do you have a trusting adult in your life? If it's an adult, who's your support structure? When you leave here, who's the first person you trust that you're going to see? Setting the standard for, if this connection is great and solemn and blessed, I can encourage you to find other connections, relations that support it and probably flow from it, a community of faith, a community of sacraments.
So then what are priests supposed to do?
Priests are, I listened a little bit to the legal commentator. So outside of the confession, priests are mandatory reporters in virtually every jurisdiction that I'm aware of. But then they are responsible. The sacraments, particularly reconciliation, confession, are meant for healing. And we don't just hear something and pack it away and try to perfunctorily go through the checklist. You know, as much as we don't want the penitent to be scrupulous and just kind of a list, we can't just be mechanical, the old manuals, as they would talk about. We need to have that engagement, at least in the few moments that we have, and to encourage them to find the help that they need. Now, sometimes we may make a tough decision. Mm. There doesn't seem to be the amendment necessary. There doesn't seem to be the confidence, even by the person expressing it, that I won't be able to avoid doing this again. Mm. Well, then, in terms of the church's power and authority, we can withhold absolution. Mm. We can say we're still under the seal, we're still bound by this relationship that is confidential, but the ability to complete this sacrament requires an acknowledgement on the part of the penitent to say, I am going to do my best
never to do
this again. And if we don't sense that reflection has even been there, we'd have to be more challenging and maybe withhold. I say that that's a very rare thing, and a young priest, any priest, should be very reluctant to withhold the absolution, but it's an option.
A quick last question for you.
Sure.
How does this make you feel?
Oh, it every time, whether it's reconciliation, whether it's, you know, the sanctity of marriage, whether it's the rituals we have even for rites of Christian burial, every time we chip away at it, whether legally, whether socially, whether economically, it's heartrending for me as someone who is, you know, a priest son of the church. It is difficult for me spiritually because the power and the benefit of the sacraments redound in some great way to the priest who presides. Yes. And every time we risk losing more people being willing and needing to go to confession, that's more time that I sit silently, maybe reading a book or just trying to pass the time hoping somebody will come.
And knock on that confessional door.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Father Paul.
You are most welcome, Monsi.
The Vatican Press Office says Pope Francis has progressively improved after he was hospitalized on Wednesday with a respiratory infection, which has now been diagnosed as bronchitis. The Holy Father was taken by ambulance to Gemelli University Hospital in Rome after having difficulty breathing. His doctors want the 86-year-old to stay in the hospital for several days for treatment, which includes antibiotics. Gemelli is the same hospital where Francis was hospitalized in July 2021 when he underwent surgery for diverticulitis. We ask that you pray for our Holy Father and those treating him. He's expected to join the Palm Sunday celebrations. Still ahead on EWTN News In Depth, a shocking new report on the founder of a Catholic organization that helped people with intellectual disabilities. What researchers are revealing and how the community is reacting.
We're just going to continue to pray and fight that the pro-life message and the sanctity of life.
Plus, moves by one state legislature to remove the option to use the abortion reversal pill. A doctor who leads the first of its kind research institute on medical abortion reversal weighs in.
We continue to wait for a decision out of Texas that could ban abortion pills nationwide. The Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine, along with three other pro-life medical groups, claim the abortion pill mifepristone is unsafe and was not properly vetted by the Food and Drug Administration. The Justice Department lawyers representing the FDA say the drug went through rigorous testing before it was approved more than 20 years ago. We will provide analysis once that decision comes down. We're also following a package of bills in the state of Colorado that essentially eliminate a woman's right to change her mind when she starts the process of a medical abortion, limiting her choices.
Especially the one that censors pregnancy centers and effectively bans abortion pill reversal process and treatment for women who are seeking to sustain their pregnancy and save the life of their unborn child.
Democrats supporting the bill say they want to protect abortion access in the state. Pro-lifers on both sides of the aisle say the bills will hurt mothers in crisis pregnancies. Reporter Roselle Rages tells us how the Catholic Church is responding and shares the story of one mother personally impacted by the abortion reversal protocol.
It's truly wonderful and such a gift to see how much joy and love one single person has brought into this world.
This mother from the state of Colorado is talking about her beautiful son, a son she almost lost. A few years ago, she found out she was pregnant, unplanned and unexpected.
Nobody thinks I can do this. I would be doing this alone, and I didn't know mentally, financially, emotionally, how I was supposed to take care of another person.
I ended up making an appointment at an abortion clinic.
She was given the first of the abortion pill regimen, mifepristone, which blocks progesterone that is needed for pregnancy to continue. But this mother had a change of heart, and in that split second, she ultimately altered the course of her life and saved her son's.
So I ended up taking the pills, and my heart broke. I never wanted to take him from the moment I found out about my baby. I loved him with all of my heart. I just thought that him not being with me was the best possible outcome for him. What are my options? Like, I have to undo this.
Within hours of taking the first pill, she called the clinic that performed what's called abortion pill reversal. She was told she had to come in to get the treatment, and it had to be within 24 to 48 hours from when she took mifepristone.
We were uncertain about, like, if my baby was still alive. Like, that was the first thing we needed to check. She took me back, did an ultrasound, and he was perfect. And she turned on the monitor so I could hear his heartbeat, and that is the most beautiful sound in the whole world.
This mother was able to get an abortion pill reversal treatment to save the life of her unborn baby. But soon, other Coloradan mothers may no longer have that option.
Yes, in the state of Colorado, last year, we had the Reproductive Health Equity Act, which allowed for unrestricted access to elective abortions for the full 40 weeks of pregnancy for any reason. This year, the legislature has introduced a package of three bills referred to as a Safe Access to Protective Health Care, which they're also referring to as REA 2.0.
Those three bills are 188, protecting healthcare patients, providers, and assisters; 189, increasing access to reproductive health care services; and 190, prohibiting deceptive practices at anti-abortion centers. Brittany Vesley, executive director of the Colorado Catholic Conference, warns that if enacted, Bill 190 would ban the abortion pill reversal treatment and advertising of pregnancy resource centers.
And this ultimately is eliminating choice for women. They're saying you only have one choice after you take the abortion pill because they're going to ban access to progesterone, and that choice is abortion. It would also restrict and censor the good work of our pregnancy centers across the state of Colorado.
Bill 190 cites the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, stating that abortion pill reversal is a dangerous and deceptive practice that is not supported by science or clinical standards. However, the American Association of Pro-Life Obstetricians and Gynecologists says otherwise.
And women do need to know that there is a second chance if they change their mind after taking Mifeprex, they can get progesterone. We know that progesterone will block the effects of Mifeprex and can change the chances that her baby will survive from about 25% up to about 68%.
Bishops in Colorado, whose diocese partner with or operate pregnancy resource centers, have been speaking out against the bills.
The bishops recognize that this violates First Amendment rights. It violates a life, the sanctity of life, first and foremost.
The bills have cleared the Senate and are headed to the House for consideration.
Vesley says pro-life Coloradans need to make their voices heard.
63% of Coloradans did not want unrestricted abortion access, but that's exactly what the Reproductive Health Equity Act did. That's exactly what all three bills are going to continue to codify and expand. So having as many Coloradans out to testify on these bills is going to be key.
Like this mother, who will continue to share her story about choosing life and staying true to her faith.
Yes, it was unplanned to me, but it wasn't unplanned to him. And it is his plan. And having a child out of wedlock, I understand that's a sin. But God turned my sin into something so beautiful. And only he can do that.
She sends a message to other pregnant mothers.
You can do this. You are loved, your baby is loved, and there are people in this world who want you and want your baby. You have to find those people. I found those people.
Rosal Regis, EWTN News in Depth.
George Delgado, a medical doctor and president of the Steno Institute, a pro-life research organization, joins us now to talk more about the abortion reversal process. Dr. Delgado, welcome. The main claims against abortion reversal include safety, effectiveness, and a lack of research and testing. What can you tell us about the abortion reversal process and the hormones used to follow it?
Well, thanks for having me, first of all. And what we use to reverse the effects of mifepristone is progesterone, natural progesterone, which has been used in pregnancy for over 50 years. So doctors have a lot of confidence in it. We know that mifepristone itself does not cause birth defects. And we have enough evidence accumulated now with the studies that we've done showing that it's effective up to 68% with our best protocols, and it's safe, no risk of birth defects, as well as the Heartbeat International data, which runs Abortion Pill Rescue Network, which now has documented more than 4,000 births after successful reversals. In the last year, the rate of problems that they've encountered with patients that they've been following after reversal has been 0.005%. That is about 9 cases in around 1,800 patients. And those complications were nausea, heartburn, dizziness, and one woman who happened to be getting injected progesterone instead of oral progesterone had some pain at the injection site. So these are not big side effects. And again, the rate is 0.005 or 5 in 100,000. So we think that this is very safe. It's very effective. We, of course, in the future plan to do more research, but think about CPR. CPR was first introduced when we knew it was effective. No one ever did double-blinded, randomized, placebo-controlled trials where you would let somebody go down on the sidewalk and say, oh, no, that person's in the placebo group. We're not going to do CPR. No, once it was proven to be effective, then you started doing it on everybody. And you can imagine that this is like CPR for the preborn baby. When the woman changes her mind and wants a second chance at life, we should not deny her that second chance at life, but instead we should offer her this treatment that has been shown to be safe and effective. And women are extremely grateful when they're given that opportunity.
When they're giving that choice, of course. Dr. Delgado, can any doctor apply this? Does it require a special license or training?
It does not require a special license, but it does require a physician who is competent and comfortable in treating women who have a situation called a threatened miscarriage. And this would be most primary care doctors and certainly obstetricians and gynecologists. So this is, for example, it's very similar treatment to a woman who comes in at 6 weeks pregnant, is having cramping and spotting. She has low progesterone levels and you supplement progesterone. Very, very analogous situation. So many physicians should be comfortable and competent in treating these women.
And what kind of follow-up does this involve? Is it a sonogram? Is it 6 weeks? Is it following them throughout the pregnancy?
Well, what we recommend is that we start the progesterone as soon as possible and also get an ultrasound as soon as possible. So we want to confirm that the baby is still alive because we don't want to treat a baby who's already passed away in the mother's womb. After that, then we usually get periodic ultrasounds probably a week later and then maybe another 2 weeks later to confirm that the baby is still alive and to make sure that the mother's doing well with the progesterone. We want to make sure that we provide the very best medical supervision for this, unlike what they do at the abortion centers where they give them some pills and send them off on their way. Then after the mother has continued to do well and the baby has survived the first trimester, then at that point, if it's a physician who provides ongoing prenatal care, then the patient can stay with that physician, or otherwise then the patient would be referred to a doctor who can provide prenatal care for the rest of the pregnancy.
So it's like following any other pregnancy. Are doctors aware of this protocol, or those patients who seek an abortion, do they have to have a special person who is actually aware of this? Is this something that's taught in medical schools?
Well, this is not being taught in medical school presently. Right now, the mainstream obstetrics organizations, such like ACOG and others, have been trying to suppress knowledge of abortion pill reversal, unfortunately. So it's usually doctors who are pro-life, who are interested in this, who know about it. But there are many doctors who don't know, and that's why I'm trying to spread the word, and I'm very glad to be on this program. We want to make sure that everybody out there knows about this so that in their sphere of influence, they can spread the word about abortion pill reversal being safe and effective. So that when a woman takes that abortion pill, mifepristone, and changes her mind, either she already knows there's a possibility of reversal, or some confidant with whom she'll counsel will tell her, hey, I've heard about abortion pill reversal. Or sometimes they'll do an online search and they'll get to the Abortion Pill Rescue Network website, which is abortionpillreversal.com, and learn more there. The Abortion Pill Reversal Network has over 1,500 doctors and clinics who are in the network who are ready, able, competent, and caring and want to help these women who choose to reverse their medical abortions.
And Dr. Delgado, have you ever treated a mother who regretted this reversal process?
I have not treated anyone who's regretted trying to reverse her chemical abortion. And even women whom I've treated who unfortunately did not have successful reversals and the abortion completed, even though we tried to stop it, even those women were extremely grateful that they took the chance and they took the opportunity to try to stop the chemical abortion. So no, I've never heard of any cases at all of any woman who's regretted trying to reverse the chemical abortion. On the other side, of course, I've heard of many women who never had that opportunity or otherwise had abortions who regretted their abortions.
Well, we hope to continue sharing this information and are grateful for your institute and your advocacy. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me. Go to stenoinstitute.org.
There are hotlines to speak with professionals about the abortion reversal pill across the country, including this one on your screen, 1-877-558-0333. That helpline is open 24/7.
When we talk about spiritual fasting, it is not fasting from food just to be hungry. We're fasting from food in order to detach us from the things of this world.
The fruits of fasting, how empty stomachs can lead to full hearts. And for the first time, footage is released of an imprisoned bishop in Nicaragua, his message to the public.
Was our city's worst day.
She had this amazing confidence, but she was a person of grace.
Remembering the victims, the city of Nashville in mourning after a deadly school shooting took the lives of 6 people, including children. Friends, family, and strangers gathered for a vigil Wednesday to honor the victims. The tragic shooting at the Covenant School, a Christian elementary school, leads our Week in Review. So far, investigators say they're still trying to figure out a motive for the shooting. Officials released video of the moments the shooter, 28-year-old Audrey Hale, shot open the glass front doors and began walking through the halls of the building. She was armed with 2 assault-style weapons and a handgun. You can see alarm lights flashing throughout the school. The deadly rampage lasted about 14 minutes before she was shot and killed by police. The victims are 3 9-year-olds, William Kinney, Evelyn Diekhouse, and Haley Scruggs, the daughter of lead church pastor Chad Scruggs, as well as 60-year-old Catherine Kuntz, the head of the school, 61-year-old Mike Hill, a custodian, and 61-year-old Cynthia Peake, a substitute teacher there just for the day. Police believe the victims were fired upon at random.
Members of the Covenant staff laid down their lives attempting to protect the children in their care. The preparation and actions of the Covenant staff most assuredly saved lives. Our police officers have cried and are crying with Nashville and the world.
Investigators say the shooter attended the school as a child and may have harbored some kind of resentment. Police have noted that the shooter did have a mental health disorder and was under a doctor's care. Detectives say Hale bought seven weapons at five different stores. The guns were purchased legally. Gun control advocates are now demanding change. Hundreds of people protested at the Tennessee Capitol on Thursday, demanding tighter gun laws. Demonstrators managed to get inside the Capitol building. Gun regulation policies are not expected to change in Tennessee. On the national stage, the debate over gun reform made it to Capitol Hill, where arguments erupted outside the chambers of Congress. While President Biden has called for Congress to take action, there are no new gun control measures in the pipeline. At least 38 men have died and dozens of others were injured after a fire at a migrant detention center in the city of Ciudad Juarez, which lies on the U.S.-Mexico border. Authorities say on Monday, migrants placed mattresses against the bars and lit them on fire because they heard they would be deported. Some surveillance video shows guards walking away and making no apparent attempt to open the cells before smoke fills the room. Tensions between migrants and authorities have apparently been high in recent weeks in Ciudad Juarez, where shelters full of people are waiting for asylum or for an opportunity to cross the border into the U.S. A political crisis in Israel. Hundreds of thousands of protesters have taken to the streets in opposition to judiciary reforms planned by the government of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The widespread criticism of the reforms has come from an unprecedented coalition across all sections of the Israeli public, the religious, secular, and business communities, labor unions, some members of the military. Despite his re-election as prime minister, Netanyahu faces a major felony corruption trial, which has been delayed several times. Protesters worry his attempt to weaken the judiciary amounts to an authoritarian power grab. The country has plunged into near chaos. The airport, embassies, schools, businesses periodically closed. Earlier this week, facing near civil war, Netanyahu agreed to pause the judicial overhaul plan for a month to allow negotiation with the opposition.
And now the government is trying to gain control of the Supreme Court. Once it does it, there is no limitation on its power, nothing. If this kind of power falls into the hands of an autocratic regime, which is also a fundamentalist religious regime with expansionist aims and with this belief in Jewish supremacy, it will set the whole Middle East on fire.
The protests are not limited to Israel. Pro-democracy groups in several cities, including in London and in New York City, have come out in support of demonstrators in Israel, protesting against Israeli parliament attempts to gain the power to override Israeli Supreme Court decisions. A new report provides details of how Jean Vanier, a prominent layperson who founded the L'Arche Federation, abused dozens of women. The L'Arche Federation is an international network of communities for people with and without intellectual disabilities to live and work together. The new report shocked the community he founded and the thousands of people who praised him for his work.
For so long, Jean Vanier was regarded as a saint by all those who worked with him, those who knew him personally, when he died in 2019, countless tributes were published, were said about him. Pope Francis himself praised him, he expressed his gratitude for his work and testimony. But the fact remains that Vanier's work has undoubtedly inspired countless faithful around the world for decades. Many of the ARC's members see this as a period of purification that can also be fruitful.
While the L'Arche Federation became aware of its founder's misconduct a few years ago, this is the first full-scale report detailing his abuse. The Nicaraguan government has released video of Bishop Rolando Alvarez sentenced to 26 years in prison for alleged treason and spreading false news.
Thanks be to God, I'm well, with a lot of inner strength, with a lot of peace in the Lord and the Most Holy Virgin.
This is our first glimpse of the bishop in months. His whereabouts were unknown until March 25th. In the video, Alvarez says he's doing well and he shares a meal with his brother and sister who visited him at the prison known as La Modelo. That prison is notorious for human rights violations. The 57-year-old bishop is an outspoken critic of President Daniel Ortega's dictatorship, which has increased its attacks on the Catholic Church in the last few years. Alvarez had an opportunity to be released to the U.S. with more than 200 other political prisoners in February, but he refused and chose to stay in his country. The man accused of murdering Los Angeles Bishop David O'Connell has pleaded not guilty. O'Connell was found shot multiple times in his home in February. 61-year-old Carlos Medina, the husband of O'Connell's housekeeper, is charged in the murder. Experts now warn that an interview a Los Angeles district attorney gave, revealing that Medina admitted to the murder, could affect the outcome of the trial. Critics say the DA's interview potentially violated due process. A motive for the shooting is still not clear. Medina is currently held on more than $2 million bail. His next court hearing is in May. In the Archdiocese of Los Angeles, a public witness to the Catholic faith through a Eucharistic procession. On the Feast of the Annunciation of the Lord, more than 1,000 faithful took part in a mass led by Archbishop José Gómez, followed by a six-mile procession. It was part of the ongoing National Eucharistic Revival launched last summer by the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. The Eucharist was placed on a beautiful float and followed by parishioners. The National Eucharistic Revival is a three-year movement that will culminate in the summer of 2024 in Indianapolis at a Eucharistic Congress that 80,000 are expected to attend. EWTN has been on the air for more than 40 years, all thanks to our foundress, Mother Angelica. Building this network began as an act of faith with a very humble start, the conversion of a garage into a television studio.
So I went down and I said to the contractor, was already digging a foundation, and I said, hold it. He said, what's the matter? I said, we're not going to build a garage. He said, what are you going to build? I said, a television studio. He said, a what? I said, television studio. We did. We did. The wonderful story. I have a book on it. You ought to get one. It shows all the wonders, wonders of God's providence. Providence. Unbelievable providence. He wanted this network for you in these serious times.
Monday was the seventh anniversary of Mother Angelica's death. We hope you will offer prayers for Mother in gratitude for her work and witness to the faith, as well as for the mission of EWTN that she set forth and that we strive to meet every day. Coming up, small pieces of tile and glass come together to make incredible art. We take you behind the scenes to show you how these masterpieces are created.
Putting one in touch with one's deepest hunger, which is the hunger for God.
But first, hunger for God. How physical fasting draws Christians spiritually closer to Jesus when we return.
As Easter nears, the season of Lent is coming to a close. During this time, we're called to fast on Ash Wednesday, Good Friday, and refrain from eating meat on Fridays. We also make a personal sacrifice, whether it's not indulging in your favorite treat or using more of your time to help others. But fasting is not just restricted to Lent. Mark Irons explains why we're called to fast beyond this season in this week's This Catholic Life report.
Time to eat. For much of the developed world, food can be consumed anytime, anywhere. Plans and routine are created around food and drink. Ash Wednesday upends the schedule with the start of Lent. 40 days of sacrificial preparation for Easter begins with a fast from food.
I think everyone should do it as a practicing Catholic.
But how seriously do we take fasting? Roman Catholics ages 14 and up are to abstain from eating meat on Fridays during Lent. Ages 18 to 59 are obligated to fast and abstain on Ash Wednesday and Good Friday.
To be honest, I don't fast in that days.
On fast days, Catholics are permitted to have one full meal as well as two smaller meals that together are not equal to a full meal. The fruits of fasting can be abundant.
It makes you more attentive to the things of God.
But to be clear, it's not just some ancient practice reserved for monasteries. Fresh from receiving ashes that first Wednesday in Lent, this Benedictine monk even had a confession.
I will say right out at the beginning, I am not avid as a faster.
Still, Abbot James Wiseman and his brother monks at St. Anselm's Monastery in Washington, D.C., follow the requirements laid out by the church. Over the years, those have changed.
There was a day when I was young when during Lent, every single weekday was a fast day.
And centuries before that, the tradition of fasting was even stronger and went beyond Lent. Now some say the practice has been forgotten.
We have mostly dropped fasting as a spiritual practice, at least as it was practiced for, say, the first 1,000 years of the church.
Fasting is mentioned in the Bible, along with early church documents. It was practiced by early Christians on Wednesdays and Fridays year-round. It seemed pretty important, so what happened? Jay Richards, a professor at the Catholic University of America, talks about that and more in his book, Eat, Fast, Feast, Heal Your Body While Feeding Your Soul, A Christian Guide to Fasting.
Fundamentally, what changed historically over time is what I would call the death by a thousand dispensations.
Over the centuries, as Catholics spread out around the world, different living, working, or dietary conditions led to bishops granting exemptions from having to fast.
Different dispensations to account for local circumstances that might have made sense at the time, but you add these up over hundreds and hundreds of years, what you find is just a kind of slow degradation of fasting as a genuine spiritual discipline.
Christ, our Lord. Amen.
In the Dürer household, the discipline lives on. It's Friday, and Leah Dürer is serving up soup and sandwiches for her children. Missing from this meal is the meat.
I'm going to not eat meat on Fridays because this was the day the Lord was crucified.
It's possible many aren't aware, but even outside of Lent, every Friday is considered a penitential day in the life of the church. That means Catholics are still called to some kind of sacrifice that day.
The more we learned about fasting and how fruitful it can be, the more deep our prayer life became.
Leah says for those just starting to fast, start small, like omitting sugar from coffee and offering it as a prayer. The family incorporates fasting in different ways throughout the year, including before particular feast days like Christmas.
You have to fast before you can feast. You really appreciate that cookie at Christmas morning so much when you're hungry from not having anything but kind of the basics the day before.
So if the fast of Lent prepares for the feast of Easter, that could call into question the timing of the parish fish fry, a tradition found at some Catholic parishes on Fridays during Lent.
Does it feel like fasting from meat or feasting on fish?
Probably both.
It kind of feels like a feast.
Oh, it's definitely a feast.
I will say for those people who are carnivores, switching to fish is an abstinence.
To learn more, we visited the Blue Ridge Mountain Range and heard from a Trappist monk and leader of his monastic community in Berryville, Virginia. Abbot Joseph Whitstock says it may be a matter of portions.
You might as well eat the meat if you're going to eat just as much fish, you know. Then you're not really being penitential.
As a religious community, Trappists are very intentional about fasting. Abbot Wittstock explained just one way spiritual growth can be achieved through the practice.
You are going against your natural inclination to eat more and to eat more. Each time you do that, the will is being strengthened.
And strengthening of the will can help to overcome other vices or temptations that lead to sin.
That strengthening translates across dimensions then into other areas of one's life.
The abbot reminds us food isn't bad, it's very good, a gift from God, and some people shouldn't fast or can't due to health reasons. But he says modern culture has a problematic relationship with food, and there is evidence in two extremes. On one end, excessiveness and the issue of obesity, and on the other, eating disorders and an obsession with body image. It's all about finding that healthy middle ground.
There's just that freedom in relation to food, and it's serving its God-given purpose, you know.
For Leah Duer, the art of fasting intentionally and spiritually didn't come overnight, but it was inspired through reception of the sacraments.
The beauty of confession and frequent confession, and which led to the beauty of sacrificing and fasting and abstaining, and how much that just lends itself to a detachment from earthly things.
The detachment from earthly things, part of the preparation for heaven. Mark Irons, EWTN News in Depth.
A great reminder that the ultimate hunger is a hunger for Christ.
And the story of an Italian artist and his incredibly talented team who are creating these beautiful mosaics to be shown in churches and cathedrals all over the world.
The artistry of mosaic dates back thousands of years and is found in many civilizations, including our Catholic Church. This artwork played an important role in proclaiming the gospel in the early church, when the Bible was not readily available to read and literacy was low. Today, it's still used to reflect God's word. Reporter Colin Flynn takes us to Italy, where artists today continue this time-honored mosaic tradition.
On their own, they are simple ceramics, pieces of glass and tiles. But when arranged by the hands of artistic masters, they join together to take on a new meaning, a new life, a beautiful mosaic. In this workshop, the artist Massimo Malini and his team produce stunning large-scale mosaics and stained glass windows, like this one, which is installed in the Cathedral of Houston, Texas. But before you get to look up and see these awe-inspiring works, they start here, one little piece at a time.
We create stained glass windows and mosaics. We work mainly for churches or cathedrals, sanctuaries, so for religious buildings all over the world.
The work is painstaking. A full mosaic can contain millions of pieces, and each and every piece has to be selected from thousands of potential colors and shades, and then cut, grinded, and delicately placed in the exact right position to create a masterpiece.
I'm working on a mosaic of St. Michael the Archangel. It's always a challenge because you have to really get into the work and understand the piece of art.
Che cosa trasmettere un po' come in tutte le arti.
For Massimo, creating beautiful mosaics is something that runs deep. This company was started and built by his late father, and as a young boy, he would help out in the workshop.
At the very beginning, just cleaning everything, you know, touching what I should not touch. And
Even at that age, did you have a sense of wonder and awe at what you were seeing around you?
You could realize that there was something special in this kind of world. You know, a wonder world, new world, just touching the material and see people and artisans working on these artworks.
Massimo's father sadly died when he was just 15, and so when he graduated school, he took over the reins and continued his father's legacy, working with their customers all over the world to bring their ideas to life.
Considering the style of the building and even the idea of the customer. So when you put all together this indication, then it's our role to develop the sketch.
The main studio is in the city of Florence, but as the company grew and their clients requested bigger mosaics and larger stained glass windows, they needed more space. And at the moment, they are working on a very special project.
This painting all started from the idea of wanting to represent a battle of angels, good and bad. But what I wanted to do is show it through a particular biblical text, which is Revelation 12.
Un testo biblico in particolare che è Apocalisse 12.
Massimo has commissioned a local artist to paint a stunning depiction of the battle between good and evil.
The battle is everywhere, all around. And here in the center we have Mary with Jesus in her womb. The enormous red dragon wants to devour the child who is about to be born. Then the good angels run in defense of Mary, the angels who have said yes to God.
Massimo's hope is that this painting will be turned into an enormous mosaic, and he has already created one small section to give you an idea of the incredible scale of this ambitious project.
We are envisioning a size of 12 meters by 7 meters, none smaller than this. And what you see here is just the interpretation in scale, in real scale of what we are thinking.
But this is the scale of that one small piece of this.
Yes, this is the small pieces. So you can imagine the entire piece of artwork, how beautiful it will be.
And for Massimo, he says his art will always stay true to tradition, a classical religious look, to help portray and communicate the depth of the faith. Outside Lucca in Italy, Colm Flynn, EWTN News in Depth.
That does it for our show. At this time next week, the EWTN Network will have special programming for Easter weekend. We'll see you the following week for more news impacting your life and faith journey. See you then.